Caroline Corey, welcome to the show.
Hey, Derek. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to meet you. And maybe we should start with a tear in the sky. You have that there in your background here on our Zoom call. And we just watched this this documentary film. The biggest thing, the tear in the sky, the name of the film, is essentially you documented a wormhole opening right there in California. What was that experience like when you sort of first realized what you had seen?
Well, first of all, I want to mention that I called the film A Tear in the Sky 2 years ago. In other words, before, you know, pre-production even.
Whoa.
Because I'm fascinated by not just the UFO itself, it's more the mechanics of the universe. You know, what is it in the space-time fabric that allows an anomaly to happen, you know? So I have my own theory on that is, you know, I think we're inside a sort of a network of wormholes, actually. And it's the patterning of space itself. And this network has specific nodes that allow some sort of anomaly to happen, because this is where the magnetic field is kind of warped, you know. So I think these nodes are all over, all around us, underneath us as well, below us. And I want to know how they work. I think the closest thing that science is, you know, talking about it in terms of a potential wormhole. So anyway, that was my fascination. And because this is where we see UFOs appear, disappear, do strange things, I called the film A Tear in the Sky. And sure enough, you know, we wanted to find anomalies, which we did, and not just any anomalies, but towards the end of the movie, as you're mentioning, all of a sudden we discover this sort of tear, basically, with objects. So coming out of it. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of prophetic in a way.
and you did not realize you had named it already beforehand. That's incredible.
Yeah. And nobody can figure out what it is. So people who are just listening, you know, we had scientists, like real nuts and bolts scientists, hardcore scientists on the team during the investigation, but also others are looking at this footage, and I haven't had one scientist come out and say, oh, we know what this is. This is blah, 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 you know, or something. So it's kind of historic in a way. Whatever it ends up being, it's pretty crazy that we stumbled on something like this.
So I've been in, you know, I was in a PhD program in virology. We were studying in Yellowstone in the hot springs, and there's these moments along the trajectory when it's like you see something that is kind of unique. You film an anomaly, and you're like, okay, then you start exploring, okay, what is this? What are the possible explanations? What is the information that I actually have? Where do you feel like you are in the trajectory of exploring this and explaining it?
Well, actually, there's still a long ways to go, because first, well, we wanted to get the movie out, of course. So we have quite a bit of data already in the film. Yes. We've ruled out everything we can think of. And again, it's not me or some woo-woo person. You know, these are scientists, so they know they're not going to just jump to conclusion and say it's this or that. So the preliminary kind of analysis has been done, and it's in the film. So we know it's not this, it's not radiation, it's not whatever. People have to watch the film to really see how that whole discovery unfolds. But so it's explained in the film already. But now we also have 600 hours of other footage and other things that we came home with. And so they continue to analyze not just this phenomenon, but everything else. And it takes forever. It's like months.
Oh, yeah.
So right now we know the size, the shape, where it's located, what type of, we know it's physical objects that kind of come out of it, you know, appear, disappear. We know the size. So that's quite a bit already. But really we have to wait for the scientists to go through more detail and also the other footage as well to perhaps put it together. Although the other phenomena that we captured could also be unrelated, you know, because everything that we captured had its own kind of properties. You know, some things were appearing, tilting, changing shape and disappearing. Other things were kind of hovering. So other things were like literally like flying down, you know, raining down. So we captured so many different types of anomalies that it's going to take many months for these scientists to come out with more specific details.
Did you choose this area? Is it known as a high UFO traffic area, or why this particular location?
Yeah, it was already known, but also what happened is because the first cast member that I had, that I found, actually was Kevin Day, who was the Navy radar guy who saw the Tic Tac UFO that the Navy released in 2017. And so was it 17, 2020? But anyway, so he was the first witness, and he, when I was researching in pre-production, okay, who's going to be in the film, you know, it's like, what is this film about? And I stumbled on Kevin Day, and so he told me that he had a team together and he's been dreaming of doing this scientific expedition. He said he already has a couple of scientists on board. He's got, this incredible person, inventor, who had a huge amount of equipment, very sophisticated things. And I was like, oh, it's perfect. And so this is how it came about. Normally I go out and I kind of put a team together from scratch, but he convinced me that this, you know, they had never done an expedition before. They were kind of just planning and hoping to do it. And so I come along, it was perfect. And so because of that, because he was the Navy guy and a couple of other people were on the same ship, the USS Princeton in 2004, we looked at it and we were like, okay, that was in Catalina, in the Catalina area. And then there were other ships as well in 2014, I want to say in 17, the USS Omaha, the USS Kidd, all Navy ships having similar experiences, tic-tac-like objects literally swarming around the ships and doing crazy stuff. And so it was kind of logical in a way, you know, it's not just one isolated incident. There's this whole trail, you know, of things happening in that area. So the idea was, could we go back to that area and see what's there? And the odds of actually capturing, like we literally captured things that were exactly the same shape and like going against the wind, just like they were describing. So that was insane. You know, I was just like hoping for anything that was significant, but we had multiple things at the end of the day. So definitely this area, there's some stuff going on for sure.
Yeah. My theory after watching the film was that it's a spaceport, was that it's a place where different ships, species come in and out. And, you know, perhaps that wormhole is like the main runway, the main entry and exit point. Just because you guys did get such a, you know, for 5 days, you got pretty good stuff. It wasn't like you just went, you picked a random place and you were like, oh, there's UFOs all over the place. What's your theory about why you had so many good observations there?
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what you said, Derek. It's that remember I was talking earlier about those nodes within the fabric of space-time, and those nodes is kind of like, you know, I see it as the magnetic field condensing, you know, creating some sort of warp where it gets so charged that you almost like, if you have an anti-gravitational vehicle or technology, you can literally just kind of zip through space or appear or disappear, because that's also, it's potentially a bending light, you know, with this warp. So if it's bending light, it's possible that we see it, then we don't see it. So I think that area is definitely located exactly at this hub point, exactly. And so that's the reason why the UFOs, whether it's ours or somebody else's, that's a different conversation, you know, are using that particular spot.
What do you think it's Earth human ships, or who do you think it is?
Well, I think it's a little bit of everything. That's another thing that I want people to, that was very clear to me, especially after making this film, that it's not one thing. And because of the types of things that we recorded, I think the things that are more physical, you know, we see a lot of orb-like things, but actual physical things that are moving strangely, or, you know, or triangles. I believe the more physical object, more material objects are human-made technology. Whether it's ours or somebody else's, that's a different question, but I think a lot of it is ours. Other things that we've captured on camera and through these other types of devices are definitely not human technology, because some of the things that I've seen is almost half organic. You know, it's kind of like light and it materializes and then it warps and then it changes shape and then it becomes material again and then not material again. I mean, that sort of technology is way, way beyond what humans know how to do.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Just as an observer, you know, if as somebody listening or watching, if you haven't just gone and watched different people's UFO footage, you know, cell phone footage or whatever, there's a whole array of different types of ships. But these things that are blobby or lights, or, you know, amorphous sort of living light structures are just really fascinating from an observer standpoint.
Yeah. And look at the technology we have right now for space travel. You know, it's like the most advanced is, you know, we're going to Mars. It's going to take like 68 years or something like that. Or isn't that the case? You know, and we're using this primitive propulsion system. You know, first let's get to the moon, then let's get to Mars, then let's get. And yeah, it's like, what, you're supposed to, it's going to take you, you know, hundreds of years to get to the edge of the galaxy, thousands of years, you know, it just doesn't make sense, you know? So there's gotta be a technology, there's gotta be a system, a universal system in place that allows intelligent life on different planets to remain in contact and communication. It doesn't make sense. Whoever invented, you know, however this universe was created, you know, to think that, okay, we're going to create these billions of stars and billions of, you know, planets and galaxies and this and that. I mean, you know, just look on this one planet, you know, there's thousands of breeds of animals and plants and different types of humans. And so whatever's behind all of this, you know, whatever it is it possible that they said, oh, okay, well, we're gonna create planets, there's gonna be planets, there's gonna be intelligent life, but nobody can communicate or get, you know, from one place to another. It's like, you know, it's everybody's so isolated, you know, it just doesn't make sense. I feel like the universe works as a whole. And the fact that we're not advanced technologically, it doesn't mean that's the way we're supposed to operate. It's like, we're not there yet, you know? So I'm 100% convinced that the most advanced civilizations open to that potential, you know, more universal laws that govern the universal, the mechanics of the universe itself, and based their civilization and their technology on this larger intelligence, which is to be able to communicate from any point in space to the other, to be able to teleport, transport. Everything becomes based on the same principle. And so I think that's how they're getting here. They're not spending thousands and thousands of years to get here. And they're like, what, they die on the ship before they get here. You know, I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And I love that you mentioned, you know, our plan is this, we're using rockets, right? We're essentially pooping out flames to go, which is, you know, train technology, steam.
Yeah.
Combustion technology, you know, so it's like we're on this track of like, we got to blow stuff up in order to move, which, you know, is just one line of thinking, really.
Yeah. And I know that there are scientists working on anti-gravitational. In fact, we do have the technology and it's like in black, whatever programs or whatever. But there's still millions of people. I mean, SpaceX and all, you know, the rockets that we keep sending up and, you know, in space. I mean, we're talking, you know, these guys are spending millions of dollars on that technology. If they have anti-gravitational in an open way, why are they, you know, as a cover-up? That's kind of stupid. it's like, let me just go spend, you know, millions of dollars just to tell, you know, to fake it, to tell the world that that's all we know how to do. Doesn't make sense. So I think, you know, there's all the politics and all the agendas and who knows, you know, to keep us in this dark age. But I guarantee that's not how the universe works. That's not how we're meant to exist on this isolated planet. You know, it's so I feel so that's another reason why I feel this film. And of course, there's more to come. And the previous one that you saw as well, always point to something much bigger, like the bigger story, you know, and to put ourselves in the context of this bigger intelligence to figure out what is really going on.
And can you just say what the different instruments you were and the different things that you were measuring in the film for those science listeners that are curious?
Yeah. So when we were planning the film, of course, most people who see UFO footage, you know, 99% of what's out there, it's usually just a regular camera, you know, sometimes it's a couple and sometimes there's many witnesses looking at the same thing. So sometimes it's night vision, which is good too. But what we wanted to do is cover the entire spectrum. You can't do a scientific investigation and just have a couple of cameras. So we had a huge amount of optical devices. So regular cameras, night vision, which measure the short range of infrared. But then we had the FLIR cameras. Each camera is like $50,000. This is military grade stuff. Wow. Yeah, and we had 8 of those. And these measure, it's 10 times the infrared range than the commercial, you know. So you're seeing great detail, thermal signature of the object, for example. And so we had that for optical. We also had radiation detectors, spectrum analyzers, RF detectors, magnetometers. So it's like we really covered the spectrum of physics, you know, all at once. And we were running all these devices 24/7. And also to achieve triangulation, we also positioned ourselves in multiple locations as well. So now we have the opportunity to really analyze this data scientifically, because then we have correlations across these multiple devices.
And with this particular event, the actual tear, what was it that clued you off to go and sort of, did somebody see it with their eyes, or was it, what was the event that said, okay, let's look at the other footage or the other data to correlate it.
This is something you cannot see with your eyes because it was so fast. And okay. So this is, so what we were doing is we were, you know, filming, you know, 12 hours a day or what have you. But then the, you know, so when we were filming, we were observing the skies and doing that in real time. But then at the same time, we had all the devices recording all kinds of data. So like the rest of the, during that time, other team members were looking at the data, you know, like, and then when you look at the data, it's frame by frame. Now you can't zip through. If you zip through it, you just miss it. Yeah. So this is how it was caught. It was caught by looking at, we're like, what? Something is strange there. And of course, the first thing we do, and we think it's a camera glitch, you know, because that, you know, okay. But of course, you know, it's not a camera glitch. It's not this, it's not that, it's not, you know. So, and then when we look frame by frame, we see these objects, you know, it's like, so it's that's how that one was discovered.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's some algorithmic AI way to, you know, if you have frame by frame for 24 hours a day for 5 days, you know, that like pings like, okay, anomaly here, and then you can go back and put the human eyes on it.
Yeah, so some of the devices already had that software within them. So for example, it would dismiss anything that registers hot that looks like that, I mean, that flight signature is like an airplane, you know, obviously, or a bird or a bug or, you know, like a satellite. So we already have those softwares in not at all the devices, but in some of them where you don't even waste time. But even with that, you still have to, it's a both thing. You still have to, once you eliminated all the obvious things, you still have to kind of make sure you didn't miss something. And that's how we do. We do it with our naked eye, but also with that type of software. So it's a combination of both.
What do you want to do next with this information that you have, or sort of like, where do you see this going?
Oh my God, I think this is the beginning of something huge. I mean, first of all, we are the first civilians ever to come out and do something, have capture anomalies across multiple devices, across multiple spectrum of physics, like I said, from acoustic to optical to this to that to radiation. And so that's already a first. And the types of anomalies that we found, I mean, I don't know which scientist is going to come out and tell us, oh, it's this or that. No one's has done that before. You would think that because you know, I'm not sure how the scientific community is like looking at it or not, but some scientists who weren't in the film are in contact with us and have seen the film, and I still don't have an explanation. You know, these are astrophysicists. These are, you know, all kinds of different types of, you know, physicists as well, astronomers and things like that. So because of that, I feel like, oh my God, we have to keep looking and trying to understand what this is. So we have to go back. This area or other areas based on more of the data that we keep discovering to really uncover what this is, because it's a lot more and a lot bigger than just capturing UFOs and saying, oh, it's our technologies, their technologies. What we're potentially tapping into is what I was saying, the mechanics of this fabric of space-time. I mean, can you imagine? So we definitely have to keep going.
And are scientists asking for your data, or it's sort of the broader community that wasn't in the film? How are they interacting with you guys?
Yeah, so some of them are asking, and so the group that that was in the film, the UAPX, so they are, and because the scientists that are part of that group, they are the ones analyzing, you know, and it's taking them forever because it's taking forever. And they will release, in fact, that's another first. They are going to write a science paper that also has never been done before, a science paper on UFOs, on the data. So, and then they're going to release all the data at the same time. However, I think, you know, if there are, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the official way of how they're going about it with the scientific community. They'll also be talking at different conferences and making presentations here and there. So
the actual scientific results are still in process. The film is like kind of an early, you know, here's our best preliminary results. You can see them. And we're going to establish more of the results, you know, to explain more clearly over time.
Like. Yeah. I mean, so there's quite a bit of, you know, understand why we even picked those anomalies to be in the film, because it was enough data to tell them 100% it's an anomaly. Now, as in terms of the properties of this anomaly, what is this thing? How does it fly? That is still being identified. But the fact that it is an anomaly, that has 100% been identified. Otherwise, we wouldn't include it in a film. You know, otherwise, you know, we can't, you know. So it's enough in the film to see the things that were ruled out by the scientists as, you know, that had mundane explanations, and for them to say these are the ones that we know 100% don't make sense, you know, from a physics standpoint. So they may find more detail. Like, for example, we have the size of these objects, we have the shapes, so they could have, maybe they'll be able to have more discussion in terms of what type of matter it is. I'm not sure, but I'm saying, like, there's enough already in there, and there's additional things that didn't make it in the film. So it's quite a big, you know, undertaking for sure.
Yeah. And personally, I would really like, if you have, you know, sort of the specific location in the sky where this was, you know, just watch it for a while and see if it's a repeating event, or, you know, if you can find, you know, I would also be curious about places like Sedona where there's, you know, regular activity, if you could find the same wormhole type event matching in one of those locations.
That's exactly the idea, because is this repeatable? Is it something that gets created? Like, can an object actually trigger that warping in that location, but then when the object's not there, it's not there? Or, as we were discussing, no, that's where the magnetic field warps, therefore you're always going to see, you know, that's kind of a big question. And that's exactly what we're going to keep doing. And, you know, we're working on all of that. Just think about this. I mean, it's crazy. It's historic. Like, I mean, to have captured, they just showed us a couple of days ago, pictures of the wormhole, of the black hole at the center of the galaxy. I don't know if you were watching that, you know, and so, you know, and here we are, like, civilians, you know, capturing stuff very close to the Earth. I mean, so at least I'm hoping that it would open the conversation. What could this be?
And I know you have, you know, personal abilities to perhaps remote view and get guidance from other sources. Have you had anyone look at trying to get information either through channeling or remote viewing? Like, what is going on with what you've observed, like, to get information from a different perspective?
I did.
Okay, fantastic.
So you have to know that the scientists in this film, I work with different types of scientists, but in this film, they're very hardcore scientists. They're like, there's no way you could be talking about consciousness or entanglement with my, you know, forget it. And so I was like, okay, well, that wasn't the purpose of the film anyway, so it didn't matter. But on a personal level, especially I was the one funding the film, I was like, oh my God, you know, this is a huge investment. This is a huge undertaking. And, you know, what if like nothing happens, you know, in those 5 days? I said, I'm going to do my own thing. And I know how to communicate, and I know how to, because I've done all kinds of, you know, types of remote viewings, among other things. And so I was like, okay, guys, give me something, you know, just one thing. And that's significant, obviously. And I just knew, I mean, that something was going to happen July 14th. And so we planned the expedition the week, you know, starting July 12th to the 16th. And sure enough, the first sighting that was in real time actually happened July 14th. And so, but it wasn't that, you know, amazing. So I'd be like in my hotel room. No, it was great. At the time, we didn't know how important it was. It was just, it looked like an orb that was like hovering and doing weird stuff. And then it disappeared. So, but then later we saw more correlations and more correlations and triangulations. So then I would go to my hotel room and I'd be like, come on, you know, something. And so it was stuff like that based on my own precognition, you know, my own way of remote viewing. In fact, it's funny, just this morning, I had a flash. I remembered that, in fact, I want to find that piece of paper. I wanted to see what was in that area. And I saw a bunch of elongated things that they weren't going sideways. They were coming down. And there was a bunch of them. They were coming down and going up. And I thought, what is that? That's not a UFO. You know, that was before the movie, right? Mm-hmm. But I was trying to remote view and see. And I just left it. I didn't pay attention. And I actually drew it and I sent it to David Mason, who's the equipment guy. So I just remembered that that's what it was. And now I'm just flashing to one scene in the movie,
yeah,
where there's these things that are literally raining down. So it was some of that, you know, abilities or whatever you call. I'm just like that. I know how to tap into information and retrieve information, and that was very helpful.
What you're describing, I believe the experience on the Navy ships, the sort of the tic tacs, kind of, were they going even in and out of the water, like from sort of mid elevation, 20,000 feet, like into the water and back out? And then also, yes. Yeah. Okay.
And we capture some of those as well, not TikTok, but you know, they look like objects kind of coming down, flashing in the water. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And the, when I've heard people talking about the anti-gravitic technology, then the sort of hybrid water air vehicle becomes, you know, you're essentially in a gravity bubble. The ship is in its own field. And so it's just as fast to fly through water as it is through air. So it's not the same as like we think of, you know, submerging.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So people really need to watch like what we're talking about to experience like, what is that? You know, like that's another thing. The typical UFOs that you see on YouTube are in the movie too, actually. But some things that we capture are so unique. I mean, so now the phenomenon is even more complex because we kind of added to the story. But I think we're the way that is headed, the way we're headed, is where it's going to bring it all together. Because if we understand, you know, again, the mechanics of the whole that's behind all of it, then everything else is going to have an explanation.
I'm curious about, you called these guys, you know, hardcore scientists, and they don't want to pay attention to remote viewing data or consciousness related information. At what point, you know, would it make sense? Or how do you think these guys will eventually start taking advantage of that all these extra sources of information that are available.
When they hit that wall, and I know that's going to happen because they're going to come up with explanation after explanation. And at one point they're going to say, we don't know, we don't know, we don't know. I have met several scientists. One of them is actually Travis in the movie, Travis Taylor. You know, he was very hardcore scientist. I met him, I don't know, like, I don't remember, but many years ago.
And maybe we should say hardcore materialist scientist.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And so I remember because we are on the same show, you know, Ancient Aliens and Unexplained and things like that. And sometimes we would do conferences together. So we'd hang out in the green room and, you know, so I remember talking to him that one time. And then I said, hey, you know, I'm doing this film and I want to interview you. And he said, and it was so, he was so like hardcore, like it's, I can only talk about hardcore science. And I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, we do want science, so it's okay. Anyway, so that was like way back. And then he's been working on Skinwalker Ranch. I don't know if you know that show, and encountering himself, having those direct experiences, all sorts of crazy anomalies. Although I think he did write something about consciousness. But then when he had those direct experiences himself on another show, he started to see the correlation between, is this all a coincidence? Like, you know, there is some sort of interaction. So now he's amazing to work with because he's got this real scientific background, but at the same time, he's so open to this could be possible. There must be a connection, you know, with consciousness, with mind. Of course, we don't know. I mean, they don't know how to prove it and or look at it, but I'm just saying like how some scientists are it's when they hit a wall, they don't have any more answers. And then they start having experiences. Then you can't deny it.
Yeah. And that's a hallmark of a good scientist, right? If you are observing things, then you know, a lot of times it starts with an observation and then you say, well, I can't discount my own lived experience. So might as well try to explain it. I mean, that's exactly what happened to me. Wild stuff was happening for years. And I was like, well, this is a little too magical just to be coincidence. So, and the way I see it is all this stuff, if I'm experiencing it, then there's a fundamental law of the universe that's making it possible.
Exactly. Exactly. And so I'm interested in that because come on, it's too many coincidences, too many people, and if the scientists, so their argument also is that there's not enough evidence of interaction between mind and matter. And I'm like, no, there is. If you really, really look, there are scientists who published papers and articles about the interaction of mind and matter, consciousness, intention over a physical object. I mean, you have William Tiller, you have, of course, Dean Radin. I mean, these are scientists who studied this phenomenon under laboratory condition, not just like just simple observation, to write a paper about it. So this phenomenon has been studied, is being studied and taken seriously by some scientists.
Yeah,
but the majority is like, no, let's stick to Newtonian laws. And Newtonian laws just can't explain it. It's just like, you can't use physical laws to explain non-physical quantum things.
Yeah. And it really, it's at this point, it's just a matter of people aren't up to date on the research. You know, there's Dawson Church's book, Mind to Matter, which has, I would say, 700 different scientific papers in the citations, right? Just go read those 700 papers and then you'll be up to speed. Like, you know, it's not a matter of there's no evidence. It's just that if you don't think there's evidence, you haven't read the papers probably.
Exactly. And that was exactly my argument. And so they pick up on the one time or something where Uri Geller wanted to prove whatever his psychic abilities on television. I don't know, something like that. Or like Spoonman, you know, they pick on a couple of like badly represented experiments that were done publicly, and that's it. They dismiss the whole phenomenon, and they don't understand that these laws are subjective, but they are laws. In other words, the fact that I can move an object today, you know, 5 degrees, but tomorrow I'll move it 20 degrees, but then the third day I can't move it, but then the fourth day I can move it again, you know, 10 degrees. So the fact, first of all, the fact that I moved it once under vacuum we're talking, not touching or moving air molecules or whatever, just right there should be an anomalous phenomenon. You know what I mean? So the fact that you're repeating it, but on some days where I'm not really concentrating or whatever, I don't do it. So do you dismiss the 100 other times where I did it? You see what I mean? So that's kind of what they're doing to try to look away, away from this whole subject.
And I can speak personally of probably as recently as 7 or 8 years ago, if you would have brought this, you know, whatever it was, maybe remote viewing or ETs, I kind of would have just been like, if someone was telling me about it, I would have just dismissed them as fringe or something.
Yeah.
So I think it's still easy. You know, if you're not interested in something, you can just dismiss it until you are interested. You were talking about this, which was fantastic, from Superhumans, where you did remote telekinesis under closely monitored
vacuum
conditions. Yeah.
Yes.
So this is you're spinning an object in a vacuum chamber from across the world.
Yes. Yes. Go explain that. And if I did that only once, I don't have to do it every day. I don't have to do it 10 times. Of course, you want repeatable results. But how is if it's not a magnetic field because I'm not in close proximity, I'm not moving air molecules because, well, first of all, I'm not there. And there's no air because of it's a vacuum. The temperature is not changing. So because we're measuring the temperature. So what is it? You see? And so that's why, you know, also people really need to watch that film, you know, on camera in, also we, every single time we do controls, we take measurements over and over a period of time. And then we see the exact time correlation when your consciousness is, I'm not the only one. There are many experiments like this, you know, people just need to take the time to research that. And so, but this is the first time that I've seen it in film in this format. So that's why Superhuman 2 is a first in a way. So I'm very excited about that one as well. And it's doing very well. I'm curious about your experience, because just from Superhuman, I get texts and emails from all around the world, from people from like different backgrounds, who tell me, and I'm talking lawyers, judges, mayors, you know, politicians, doctors, regular doctors, like MDs, police officers, you know, the type of people that you would think are by the book, even scientists too. And then they would tell me in the message, I saw your film and it triggered something. I remember that I had this experience and that experience and blah, blah, blah. And it opened my mind. And so I'm ecstatic because we always dismiss these things that happen to us. Like, oh, that was a coincidence. Oh, that can't be. Like what, you know, like, I just thought of something and the guy just called. Okay, it's a coincidence. I saw something that was going to happen and it did. I don't know what, but come on, too many people and too many times. You can't ignore it. So yeah, that's what the other film does. But I'm curious, what was the event for you that changed it?
Well, I'll tell you about that in a second. But after the film, I just want to share with you that we just made some of those Psy wheels and we sat down and played with them. I have two little kids, a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And we just started trying to see if we could turn them. And a couple times I could feel the link between yes. me and the Psy wheel. And I was like, ah, and it's a very specific feeling of connection in a way. And the way that I was approaching it was like trying to imagine myself as this, as the wheel spinning. So what would it feel like for me to be that wheel spinning? And then it would kind of like give a little spin for us. And it was so easy. I just loved like how accessible it was for all three of us to get a little bit of movement from these wheels on our first try with no practice.
Yeah. And so now, of course, we teach that we did that on camera with this, the guest at the time. And she had never done anything like this before. She was never trained. She didn't even know like what to expect. And we just trained her in 2 hours. We were like, you know, this is it. And she figured that out herself. What you're just talking about, the connection. So first, like she didn't know. And then the second she was inspired to talk to them, like to say, you know, piece of paper, I want you to rotate or whatever. So she made it very personal. She created a personal connection and said, I'm going to call, I don't remember the names actually. I'm going to call, there was two of them rotating. I'm going to call one, I don't know, Bob and Juliet or something like, I don't remember. And what that did was established a personal connection of some sort, as opposed to I am separate from this physical world in front of me. It's more like, oh, my energy is connected to these physical objects and I know who they are. It's Bob and Juliet or something, you know, whatever. So by doing that, you know, it was a different, it started to respond. And then the second, it was like, we were like, it was still for like 20 minutes and we're rolling cameras, you know, like I'm looking at the budget and at the clock, you know, rolling 6 cameras from all angles, nothing's happening for like 20 minutes. And then the second she says, I'm just going to give it love, love. I love you. She starts saying love the second she says love. And that thing started to spin like crazy. It was like crazy. So there is something happening with the energy and the connection.
And it's a good reminder for me. Every time I try to do one of these things and I'm like, okay, I'm going to do it. And I'm kind of forcing it and pushing, it doesn't work. There's the element of love, but also just the sort of very relaxed focus that seems so important to, exactly, to getting these effects. Is that how you did it when you were spinning them? What's your approach to spinning a wheel?
Yeah, so I'm very methodical. Like I like things very organized because I've created so many methods for meditation, all kinds of things. So for this one, first of all, there's a specific way to meditate to prepare yourself. A specific meditation that I call connecting to source. It's on my website. It's free of charge, but it kind of creates this very specific alignment and it raises your vibration and it keeps you concentrating on the object. And then I also address all sorts of subconscious beliefs and thoughts before you do anything, because if if you're saying, oh, I'm going to spin this object, I'm going to do this and that, I'm going to bend the spoon. And then your subconscious mind is saying, I'll never do this. This will never work. I'm not able, whatever. So you're kind of sending two conflicting signals to what it is, whatever it is that you're trying to do. And so I have a method where we bring up all of the subconscious thoughts and beliefs that could be standing in the way, release those, get you to a place of being 100% aligned and believing and feeling, align that with proper feeling. And then you intend for whatever it is that you want to see happen. And then this is where the relaxation happens, is that you just allow, you just pull back and you just expect nothing. So it's really very methodical. It's very specific in the way I go about it.
And something like that could be applied to if, you know, I work with a lot of entrepreneurs, and these beliefs, these barriers that you might not even be aware of, that can just get, you know, stop you in your tracks from earning money or creating a film or whatever it might be. So I'd love that you're, you know, just clearing these hurdles out of the way.
Exactly. So I have a whole, it's called the creative formula. It's like very specific. First, it's your energy. Also, the way you articulate your intention. You know, you'd be surprised how many people say, oh, I want a new house, or I want to attract money, or I want money, or, you know, I want a new career or whatever. But the way, like, they don't know how to specifically articulate it. So the intention, the words that you use, the feelings, you know, and the belief, I want to do this, but I can't, you know, I'm a failure. I failed before. All of this is you. It's you wanting to do something. So you're putting all of you, who you are, into that creation. And if some of you is not aligned, it's going in the opposite direction, it's just not going to happen. So it's called the creative formula. It's very popular on my website.
Oh, excellent. What is your website?
Well, it's actually carolinecorey.com. It will take you to the Omnium website, which has a ton of free stuff on my YouTube, but classes and sessions and training. So you have the training that we've been talking about, also remote viewing, and also the blindfold, you know, doing the training with the blindfolds. And I mean, it's like, I think there's like 600 classes and sessions. On
that's quite a lot. I was browsing through that section, and I noticed the training for kids, which I was especially interested in, given what I'm playing around with my own kids. Could you say any more about what that program is?
Yeah. So what I love about this program, the kids are so easy. I mean, you give them a mask and you tell them, and then you just tell them to just relax and have fun. And then you grab a piece of paper or color paper or what have you, and you say, okay, tell me what you see. And they just tell you, you know. It's whereas an adult would be like, well, what do you mean? I can't see anything, you know, and how does that work? And she's crazy or whatever. And so the process with kids is totally different. It's organic. It's simple. And they, like 99% of the time, from the first or the second session, they can see colors. Then they end up reading. They end up being able to see also in another room, you know, remotely, behind their head, behind their back. So it's super easy. And I think the session for kids is only four classes or something, four or six classes, just because they're so fast. The adults, on the other hand, it's a whole different, I mean, that's the reason why I mentioned earlier, you have to go through, because the adult's going to be like, this is not going to work, doesn't make sense, da, da, da. You have to address all of that. And so, and I think also there's something in age range. I feel like, you know, from maybe 5 to 9, I believe, you know, even younger, the brain functions very differently. The learning process is very different as well. So that also allows, other than the belief systems, but also in general, children are just like sponges and it's just so easy.
Hmm. What have you learned from observing how these kids go about things?
That adults are complicated. That, you know, they complicate things, and also the more they advance in age, the belief system gets so piled up this is how patterns are created. And once patterns are created, it's almost like you have to uncreate what you created before you can defy the laws, you know, this is exactly what we're doing. We're telling the brain to read without physical eyes. So technically that shouldn't happen, you know, because you see with physical or without light, because you see, because light is bouncing off an object and then it's transferred back to into your eyes. So then you see, but if it's total darkness, technically you shouldn't see. Mm-hmm. And so this is a crazy, you know, reprogramming for the brain. So the adults have to undo all sorts of patterns before they can get there.
Yeah. And if I'm correct, you were measuring brainwave activity, and in the optic nerve, or the part of the brain that parses the visual cortex, was lighting up with the blindfold. Is that right?
Yeah. So we noticed that a part of the brain was behaving as if there was light, even though there was no light. And the analytical part of the brain, when you read, you know, there's parts of the brain that fires, you know, it was behaving as if you were actually reading, even though the person was reading, but it was total darkness. So the brain was functioning as if there was light, even though there was no light.
Wow. And this is the blindfold reading. In both kids and adults?
Yeah. Those who can do it eventually. But most kids can do it, like I said. And so people, you know, please, like those who are just listening to this and going, oh, it's fake or blah, blah, blah. Or no, it's not. Because we've demonstrated it in a live conference online. I have that on my website. I mean, you have the kid and an adult, actually. We demonstrated with them. They close their eyes. There is a tape. There's another tape. And then the mask. There's like literally black masking tape, you know. And the eyes are shut because, you know, it's like, so it's what I'm saying is, like, for people to say, oh, you know, maybe there's like a hole somewhere. No.
Yeah, and the more you, you know, the more you repeat these, right, then statistical significance comes into play.
Exactly.
I wanted to circle back. You said something about a couple times, like, oh, these cameras are rolling, it's getting expensive. You said you funded the films. I was kind of curious. Yeah. What's the model for how you run your life, all your endeavors that sort of funds everything you want to do?
I mean, it took me a long time to get to this, but you know, because I started out teaching all this material and doing classes and stuff, but that's not enough to fund big projects like this. So, so I had sponsors in the beginning who supported me to put movies out. And then eventually those movies started to be successful, that eventually I started to be independent, where I would, whatever income I would get, I would just reinvest in a project, and so on and so forth. And so now it's kind of like, that's what, I mean, I still need sponsors sometimes, especially when it's a very big project. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly my savings, basically. Yeah.
Cool. And one of the questions I had was, Yeah, because I know some blockbuster movies make a lot of money, but I didn't really know, you know, documentaries of the type that you're making, can they be profitable?
Well, it depends. Most documentaries out there are very cheaply made, if you notice, especially in the UFO world. I'm not talking about the big, you know, kind of serious BBC kind of research, not the or National Geographic. I'm talking about the independent films. Most of them are very cheaply made. And usually, I mean, it depends, but you could eventually make your money back. I like to keep the production value very high. I mean, you saw my last film, especially this film. I mean, we were filming with red cameras, you know, for people who know it's the top, you know, types of cameras. We had maybe 10 cameras running at the same time because we were in multiple locations. Everything from sound editing, sound design to everything is top, top notch. And so I like to keep that quality again, because it's not out there. So all of this costs money, but it's representative of my work. You know, I feel like I don't want to, so it takes me longer to make the money back, but, I feel like I'm on a roll now because I'm putting out material that's never been seen before. The angle's very fresh, very different. Science, you know, trying to make the paranormal normal, you know, using science, using real life experiments on camera, all of that, that sort of validation, it hasn't happened in this way, in this type of format. So on top of this, if it's well made quality wise, you know, production wise, it's even more so. Anyway, to answer your question, it's harder for me to make back the money, but I eventually do. And that's what's been helping me so far with a couple of sponsors here and there when needed.
Okay, great. Yeah. And I'm asking just because a lot of people that listen to this show, people that I work with, it's helpful to understand, right? Once you can get things in a self-sustaining way, and right, the whole thing can grow organically. But getting things into momentum in that way, is important. So your sponsors, were these like personal sponsors or organizations, or, what types of sponsors are we talking about to get things started?
Actually, it's all sponsors. All the sponsors are people who have studied with me, that have seen me lecture, and they've taken classes and or sessions, and they very much believe in my work because it's helped them. They've improved their lives. They've healed from things, so that's the reason why they genuinely believe in my work. And some of them are well off, and so they sometimes approach me and say, is there something I can do, you know, because you helped me, I changed my life. And so that's kind of the type of sponsors I've had a couple of sponsors come, like, I didn't know who, like more investors. I personally like didn't want to go there. It just felt very business-like, very transactional. And I try to keep it more energy-based, you know, like we're in this together, those who believe in it, you know, it's your way of contributing. So it just feels more based on truth and love and support, you know, as opposed to like, you know, this investor. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying that I've been able to do it that way so far. And I'm very grateful.
Yeah. I was just 2 days ago, I was chatting with Jason Shurka, who has the Unified.tv platform, and then his Unified Social, and a lot of the films and documentaries he's producing are funded by the memberships, you know, and he said, I have this toroidal structure in mind where, you know, we're giving value, people are exchanging money for the value, and we then turn around to use that money to create more of these documentaries that are valuable. So it's a circular system.
Yes.
sustainable. You know,
it's so funny you mentioned Jason. Of all the people, you mentioned Jason Cherka. I mean, it's crazy. You see how the universe works, because I just get an email from my PR, you know, the people who are helping book me on shows and stuff like that. And Jason Cherka was one of the people that booked somebody else, my cast, another cast member who's not into consciousness and stuff like that. They're very sciencey. So I told them to tell Jason that it's more appropriate that I talk about the kind of stuff that he talks. So it's funny that, you know, just now, literally, of all the hosts and all the people, like you're mentioning, oh, I just emailed Jason Cherka. So because the PR team doesn't know exactly who's what, it's whoever is available or something like that. So I told them to tell Jason, but I don't know where the message got. Oh,
that's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's a community, right? A lot of these people with these platforms, I'm starting to realize as I, you know, my show, this show, the Derek Laudermilk Show, started off as more entrepreneurship, more on the digital nomad, adventure, travel, freedom lifestyles type of thing. And this goes back to your question about what some of my experiences were. And I've had several. The one that I feel called to share with you is we were living in Portugal at the time. And every night I was dreaming of crop circles. And I would wake up and I'd be like, wow, what a beautiful dream. And I would ignore it. And then again and again and again. And finally, I was like, okay, Google crop circles. What the heck are crop circles?
Oh, you mean you didn't even know of crop circles?
I just was sort of aware that they existed, but I didn't know anything about them.
Wow.
I had seen the National Geographic article, like, hey, crop circle tourism is a thing. And that's as far as I knew. So I started researching after these dreams. What are they? How are they formed? You know, what do we think they are? And they are so fascinating. And very linked with the UFO phenomena. You know, as soon as I started researching crop circles, I started watching footage of UFOs. And I was like, okay, I understand, you know, it's not always just a UFO coming and making a crop circle, but these other beings, interdimensional consciousness, all started coming together to me. That's when I started listening to channels for the first time. So yeah, wow. I kind of put all the pieces together for me.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to tell me this is not, you know, just our conversation, you know, you mentioned this guy out of nowhere. I just happened. And then, you know, you're minding your own business and you dream about, I mean, come on, there is a mechanism behind all of this that's bigger than us. And that is consciousness. It's because we're operating from the level of consciousness. We're not operating from this brain. There's something you are, universal consciousness. I am universal consciousness. And all consciousness is entangled behind the scenes. There's no question in my mind. And information travels everywhere and can be anywhere, everywhere at once. And that explains telepathy, teleportation, you know, you dreams, all sorts of stuff. I don't get it why, like, scientists don't want to look into that. You think it's so fascinating, you know what I mean? They just want like a hard thing, like a something to hold on to, which is
yeah, I get it. And that's, you know, I've been there, you know, really looking at, I was looking under the microscope all the time and looking at my little viruses and bugs and whatnot. Remote viewing is one of those things that I feel like is pretty accessible, pretty easily validated. Mm-hmm. Like you could have this person in a room, remote viewing a known location, right? We know exactly what's there, and they can describe everything that's there. And then you can be like, yes, you know, it matches the checklist of what we know is already there.
Right. Or, I mean, you can easily test it, you know,
you can
have somebody go to another room. You don't know, you've never been to that room, but you can just describe what's there and then you can go check it, you know, so it's very verifiable, you know, remote viewing. And so we did that in the film in Superhuman, but also for people who don't know, the government, you know, was using remote viewing to spy on a different country. And so it started out with the Russians, and then the US said, wait a minute, like we need to be doing that. We need to be spying on them. And so they're training soldiers to use their psychic abilities to remote view, to spy psychically on the military bases in Russia. So, and they did that for 20 years. I mean, if it doesn't work, like, why are they bothering with, you know, they could just say, this is crazy, woo-woo stuff, forget it. But they were getting real data. They were actually drawing the exact shape of the building, the entrance, the exit, you know, where the offices are, where things are. It's crazy. It does work. And it's verifiable.
And that, I can't remember who was talking about this, but then they have the, you know, the defensive psychic defenders, right, to try to block the other people who are remote viewing. So you're
I did you that
know, you did
I did that in the movie.
Oh, in the movie.
No, in the movie I demonstrated that.
I don't remember that part.
Tell me about the military. Wait, tell me about the military.
Yeah, so you have your team of psychic spies, right, and then you have your defensive unit, which is trying to intercept the other psychic spies and obscure their viewing.
Yeah. And so when I did that with Paul Smith. Paul Smith was one of the officers in the army at the time who trained the soldiers. So he was in the program. It's called the Stargate program, for those who want to look it up. And so he's in my film, in the scene, in the remote viewing scene. And I told Paul, because I believe in the whole consciousness and ability to do this, but to also potentially block. So I told Paul, I said, well, we can demonstrate, you know, if it was Rachel in the movie who was sitting in the room with him, and I went to another location that she's never been to. She had no idea. In fact, she was in a different state. We brought her where we were filming. So she had no idea about anything. It could have been in a McDonald's, you know, it could have been anywhere. And so anyway, I am at this location, and I told Paul at one point, I want to try to block her. And he said, no, it doesn't really work. And, you know, because I don't know what, we've tried it, didn't work. So well, we'll try, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So here I am in the other location, and I'm like touching things, I'm seeing things and observing things. And she is trying to remotely, psychically view what I was doing and what I was looking at. And so she's like writing one thing after another and drawing things exactly. Like I'm holding on to bars, like hard metal bars. And she's like, I mean, it was crazy, the correlation, all the things that she was seeing. And then at one point I sit down and I try to block her, right? And so I put myself in a shield and I said, now she can't see anything. And literally you should see it, like simultaneously, she's drawing stuff and writing stuff. And all of a sudden she's like, that's it. I'm done. it was like hilarious, you know, to see it. The time crawl exactly at that time. She's like, I'm not getting any more.
Wow.
Like, she was like blank. So that was kind of interesting as well, to show that how consciously your intention. So all I did was my intention was to block, like anything that would come my way would be totally blocked, blank, and it worked.
It was incredible. That's first of all, I mean, it's just fun. Like I can see, you know, you're smiling about this. It's fun to like, yeah, let's see if I can and just play around with this stuff. And it also reminded me of another story, a similar story. Elizabeth April, she's a channel, a psychic. She's been on the show recently. She was telling me this story about, she was remote viewing. No, she called it astral projecting, I believe. Cause she said, she was walking around Area 51 in an astral body.
Right.
And there were these astral military units that kicked her out. Like they picked her astral body and like flung it out of the base, and she landed back in her material body. And she was like upset at them. She was like, you don't do that to me. So she went back cloaked and found out, you know, who everybody was, and found the like room where the military personnel was kind of in their trance state. So she found their bodies in addition to finding their astrally projected bodies. Really interesting stuff.
Wow, that's pretty wild. Also about people meeting in dreams and stuff like that. Yeah, it's fascinating. But yeah, so some people call it astral travel. They do it differently. I do different techniques of remote viewing. Sometimes it's not so much like the military does. It's a different type. So everybody has their own technique, whatever works, as long as it's accurate. You know, that's another thing, to know exactly how to do it. And to always do it in a safe way, you know, not kind of like, oh, I'm just going to leave my body and go float around. Don't do that. You know, you have to know exactly how to do it and stay protected.
I am rereading the Carlos Castaneda books right now. And the teacher, Don Juan, says, never let anyone know where my body is. Especially other sorcerers. And, you know, because it's like, he doesn't want to be, if he's traveling on some other plane, he doesn't want someone to mess with his actual body.
Right.
Where it is. Could you talk a little bit about the technique that you use to get into a state where you can remote view? Yeah. Like, what's the induction process like?
Well, the preparation is a little bit like what I was talking about before. You have to, you know, be in a meditative state, concentrate. And more importantly, you have to bring up all the subconscious stuff, know how to release it. So you have to, every time you want to do anything, you have to do all of those steps, you know, which most of the time is ignored. Like, for example, the military, you just have to quiet down and then you just write the first thing that comes to mind. It's very, very different. And so then once you are in that state, I mean, you cleared everything else out. Of course, you put yourself in a bubble. That's the protective shield. And people should, I mean, I work with the planetary grid. So again, going back to these nodes, right? There are specific nodes and coordinates that are everywhere. And so you kind of, if you don't know, your higher self knows, basically you find the closest coordinate to your physical location where you are. And that particular node can take you to any node, you know, around the planet. Mm. And so, yeah, because it's instantaneous, basically. And so you don't know exactly like the coordinates just above Area 51, but your higher consciousness does. All you have to do is your intention, put yourself in the node that's the closest to your physical location, and instantaneously it will take you to the coordinates of that's right above or below whatever it is that you want to do, Area 51, the closest one, because you're navigating the time-space continuum. And well, actually, it's three grids within a grid. There's a whole thing that I talk about in my other films. But people can also go to my YouTube channel and just find the video called Planetary Grid. And then you'll see all of these network, you know, basically this geometry, three grids within one large grid, and all these nodes. These nodes are intersection points, vertex points, where you are outside time space. If you're outside time space, then you can be anywhere and everywhere instantaneously, just like that. So that's kind of how I do it. It's very technical. My stuff is very technical and it's very precise. It's not just like, oh, think of love. And then like, you know, just imagine you're there. And that's, I mean, that's fine. I'm just saying that's how I work. It's very, very specific. And because I see the subtle energy, like I can see your energy, exactly what it's doing. And then when we're working together, I can see if you're doing it correctly, or I can see what you're focused on. So I can tell you, okay, you're focused on, you're distracted. You're thinking of your father right now or something like that, right? And so I can, so then you bring back your focus. So I guide in a certain way because I can also see very clearly. And then I can see where you're going and how you're like, how you are moving. Yeah.
Okay. Let's say someone's thinking about their father. How do you perceive that?
So like right now I can see, actually I do see that your father is around actually. So it's kind of, does that make sense? You're smiling. but anyway, but I see like, because I don't know your father, I don't know what he looks like and I don't know, but you, I read the information the way you relate to your father. That's why I know it's your father because I'm reading your consciousness. And so if you're thinking about the person that you call your father, then I'm tuning into you, then I'm going to say it's your father. Does that make sense? Even though I never met them. Sorry about that. I never met them. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I don't recall that I was actively thinking about my dad before you said, you know, thinking about your father. But then of course I was thinking about him. So
he's occupying a big part of your brain there for a while. I don't know what's going on, but he's definitely there.
That's fascinating. Would you be willing to, I don't know, is there a way that we can experience your expertise? Like either, that's really cool that you're seeing something in my field. Is there any, now it feels like I'm asking you to do a party trick, but like, can you share anything of your abilities with our audience?
Well, I mean, I can do all sorts of stuff. I do this for a purpose. Like, you know, are you blocked somewhere? Is there something that's troubling you or, you know, this that you're struggling with, you know? And so what happens is then I can read the information and give you the root cause. And it's usually, I mean, something like that is probably more helpful, you know, that because I'm literally looking into your subconscious mind. If it's a conscious thing, then you wouldn't have a problem with it. The fact that you're stuck, I'm not saying you're stuck, I'm just saying in general, if you're stuck on an issue, it means there is a root cause that you're not aware of. Because if you're aware of it, then you wouldn't have the issue. Does that make sense? So as you're telling me I'm stuck with relationships or money or my mother or whatever, then I can see, I can read the information in your subconscious mind and help you clear that.
Okay. Maybe you could, okay. If my dad just popped up into my subconscious and you picked up on that, can you discover any more about why he was in that part of my brain or whatever you were seeing?
I don't know. For some reason, like the first thing is like, he's very like making cheese. He wants to be very present. And I feel like this is turning into a session, but, but it's a little bit, I feel like he wants to make sure you're okay. I don't know. He's like, there's this protective, like I'm here, I'm present. You know, he's very like wanting care, like really concerned about you, and just kind of he wants to be integrated in your life, kind of like he wants to be very present. And I mean, that's kind of the energy that I'm picking up with your dad. Is that making sense at all? Or
it's nice to think about. I'm gonna play this for him and see what he says. For a long time, I was traveling, living in different countries around the world. And when we had our kids, we came back here to the same city, St. Louis, where I grew up and where they still live. And so we see them now. We see them, you know, for family dinners, and they get to hang out with the kids, their grandkids. And so it's been really nice having them back in my lives, my parents, both. And there's some statistic, right? When people leave for college, they've already spent, you know, 90% of the time that they ever will with their parents. And it's, oh my gosh, you know, in the next 50 years, I'll only see my parents 1 week a year. So yeah, I've been thinking about that recently, you know, like how wonderful it is to be a parent and hang out with your own parents.
He's very present, and I feel like he wants to take advantage of every minute of the day. He wants to be there for you. Like, it's very positive. It's nice, but it's very, like, a little bit too close, like a little bit. Nobody should be inside your field. They should be on the outside. And right now he's like in your brain. So
that's interesting.
Yeah.
and I would say that that's subconscious or unconscious, because in normal interactions, he's like the perfect amount of engaged.
Oh, but his heart, he's like, he really wants, like, he can't believe like how, yeah, he's very, he wants to make sure you're going to be okay. Kind of like, you have to ask him.
Yeah, that's yeah,
but this is a positive thing. But usually we, like I said, it's not to get into negative things, but usually like this is helpful, like I said, for people when if they're struggling with something, they can't figure it out because they've worked on this and they've, and so then I can see like a root cause of the issue in the subconscious very quickly, and that kind of helps release it.
Yeah, I was kind of curious. You know, you mentioned these sponsors because they believed in your work. And so before you were even making films, you had, I don't know, decades perhaps of doing healing work and helping see in the subconscious. Could you talk a little bit about how you started making films? How you made that transition?
Yeah, so actually, like you were saying, I think 2005 is when I started. I wrote a couple of books, and then I started teaching publicly, you know, before I was just kind of working with friends and stuff. And so I created all these methodologies, and I was doing workshops and sessions and lectures and things like that. That's why I have this massive library.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, and so because it's all these different methodologies. And so, and I was also training people to do what I do because it was very effective, and we were getting validation, like I was saying. So somebody would come, I mean, it was from simple thing. I mean, simple, it's not simple, but you know, patterns like stuck with money issues or relationship issues or whatever issues, and things would clear very quickly, to serious things like cancer and things like that. Now, having said that, not because we've cleared even phase four cancer in some cases, that everyone is going to clear, because again, it depends on the individual. You know, it's like we do the energy, or we help with the energy and clear the root cause of the subconscious, but then the person needs to continue with the same intention and things like that. But anyway, the point being, I've helped so many people clear very serious stuff, from mental, emotional to physical, and with great results. And so because of that, I wanted to then validate the connection between consciousness and the physical world. So I started working with scientists on the side and doing experiments, like remotely. Because I was doing sessions remotely. And so it was kind of the same thing. What can I affect an object remotely? So if I can see your energy field, but can I move an object that's there? Like, how does that work? So I started to figure out myself, is it the same principle? Do I do something different? Anyway, so I started experimenting with different scientists, and like we were affecting, you know, electrical devices, they were going nuts, and electronic device. So something was happening, and that gave me the confidence that this is measurable, and then we can actually show it on camera. So I researched that subject in terms of filmmaking, from a film perspective, is there wasn't really, there was tons of people telling us the mind creates and positive this, and we're all one. I mean, there's a lot of on the subject, but nothing that shows what that was. And so that convinced me that not everybody wants to study, not everybody wants to read books and take workshops. You know, a film is much easier to digest. So that's how I started making films. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm from the Show Me State, Missouri. Our motto is the Show Me State. And there's a certain percentage of the population that just wants to see it first, and then they can start believing. And then they can go and create their own experiences, you know, the lived feeling of trying some of these things. That reminded me of the pH, the pH effects that you can measure, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, the pH. I did the pH experiment long distance the first time because the scientist I was in, I don't remember where, I think I was in LA and he was in San Francisco or something. Or anyway, so we, like the scientist I was working with wasn't in the same area. And I said, well, let's try long distance because we've tried other things long distance. And we had effects. And again, for people who are listening, you know, we do controls, you know, we take the measurement, the pH of water over a period of time and a few hours before, then exactly, let's say at 3 o'clock, I try to look at it and say, well, pH change up or down or whatever. And so, sure enough, it would change, but it wasn't huge. It wasn't significant. It would change enough to show, okay, well, there is an effect. So we did that several times. And we also experimented with different types of water. Like, should we use, spring water? Should we use distilled water? Should we, you know, so we tested different things to know why this works, what, you know, and then we were consistent, you know, because that's how you study scientifically. And so I did that for a while. And even though the effect wasn't huge, but it was enough. And so then I said, I'm going to put that in the film. And then when I went and I worked with him in person, and the effect was much stronger. In this case, it was a little stronger. And so that's how we did it in the film. And in the film, actually, the time that we did it was pretty significant. It was a whole decimal, which is a lot to bring. Yeah.
On the pH scale, it's actually 10-fold.
It's huge. Yeah. And so we did that on camera as well, which was crazy. So
great. And so you're making the water more acidic or basic just with your intent.
Exactly. And if you are made of water, mostly water, it means that you can change the acid alkaline balance in your body, which we know is very related to viruses and bacteria and your health in general.
Yeah.
So just think about that.
Amazing. Yeah. This is really enjoying talking about all this stuff. I want to be mindful of your time. And so perhaps if there's anything that I haven't asked you about, maybe especially in terms of your most recent film that you'd love to share, we'll just open it up.
I just feel that everybody should watch that film because it's a breakthrough. I mean, no one's ever done anything like this before, not even the government, you know? So we're ahead of the game in actually measuring things and, bringing so much data, measurable data to the public. And those who are not necessarily into UFOs, you know, it's more about the mechanics of the universe, what's even allowing anomalies to happen. And, you know, it just always reminds you of our place in the universe, you know? So that's the reason why I feel, whether you're into the subject or not, the way we've done it and the implications are so huge that I really would love for people to just watch it for themselves. And just go to aterrainthesky.com. It's mostly available. I mean, it's a little bit everywhere. Amazon is very popular. iTunes is popular, but if they are in different parts of the country or the world, just go to the website aterrainthesky.com, and then they'll see where they can watch it. So I'm very excited about that.
Perfect. Yeah. And thank you so much for doing this, for leading the way. You know, we need mavericks. Maybe we need lead investigators, people that probably have been talking about doing this stuff. And I'm happy you're making it happen.
Thanks so much for having me. That was awesome, Derek.
Yeah. Thanks, Caroline.